The teaching of the Bible alone is that sinners are saved by grace alone, through faith or belief alone, in Christ alone, so that all the glory goes to God alone.
The law is given for the knowledge of sin. It is not given for the justification of the believer. And that is the legal use of the law. To try to use the law in a way of justifying oneself is an illegal use of the law.
Protestant orthodoxy taught that man was a sinner, depraved in all his parts and functions, and therefore desperately in need of divine grace.
You're listening to Trinity Foundation Radio. I'm your host, Steve Matthews. Thanks for joining me for Episode 11, Part 2, as I continue my discussion with Tim Kaufman about his Trinity Review, Recovering Irenaeus. You made this, I think, a very interesting point here. You noted that Rome uses Irenaeus to prove the early origin of the mass sacrifice, but that to do so, Rome commits some of the most egregious offenses in all of Eucharistic historiography, this quoting from your paper, and that, quote, "the mass sacrifice is therefore extracted from Irenaeus through an extraordinary deception," end quote. Please, if you could, discuss the ways in which Rome uses dishonest scholarship to make Irenaeus say what he does not say.
Okay, yeah. That's a key point from the article. And as we've already discussed, Roman Catholicism teaches that in the Lord's Supper, Christians are to transubstantiate the bread and wine into Christ's body and blood and offer it as a sacrifice for sins to the Father. And what we eat is what has been transubstantiated and offered to God for sins. And there is a part of Irenaeus' work in Against Heresies that seems to say exactly that. And it is from that same section we just cited about the union of flesh and spirit. So let me just revisit that section and add one more sentence, and I'm going to quote it the way Roman Catholics wish Irenaeus had said it. And again, we're in Against Heresies 4:18-5, and we just spent some time on this, so it'll be familiar to our listeners. "But our opinion is in accordance with the Eucharist, and the Eucharist in turn establishes our opinion. For we offer to him his own, announcing consistently the fellowship and union of the flesh and spirit. For as the bread, which is produced from earth, when it receives the invocation of God, is no longer common bread, but the Eucharist, consisting of two realities, earthly and heavenly, so also our bodies, when they receive the Eucharist, are no longer corruptible, having the hope of the resurrection to eternity." So, again, that's Against Heresies 4:18-5. And I want the listener to hear that and listen very, very carefully. So I want to read the key sentence again so that the listener understands that we're talking about the invocation of God or the consecration of the bread and wine, because it sure looks like Irenaeus is talking about offering consecrated bread and wine to the Father, that is, the body and blood of Christ, just like Roman Catholics do. So reading it again. "For we offer to him his own, announcing consistently the fellowship and union of the flesh and spirit. For as the bread, which is produced from the earth when it receives the invocation of God, is no longer common bread, but the Eucharist, consisting of two realities, earthly and heavenly." So, Irenaeus is saying we offer to God his own because when the bread is consecrated, it takes on two realities, earthly and heavenly. I would not be exaggerating if I said that 100,000% of all all patristic scholars assume that he's talking about the offering of the body and blood of Christ to the Father, and that this is just evidence that the medieval liturgy of offering consecrated bread goes all the way back to at least to Irenaeus, who claims to have heard it from Polycarp, who of course heard it from the apostles. So the listener might well ask, "Hey, Mr. Kaufman, you promised us that Irenaeus was just talking about the tithe offering, but now that you've read it in context, he's obviously talking about the Roman Catholic sacrifice of the Mass because he's talking about offering consecrated bread to the Father." So I'll just say, yeah, it sure appears that way. It does. It absolutely does. Unfortunately, that's not what Irenaeus wrote. And if he had, I suppose it would be an argument that they could use, but Irenaeus didn't write it, didn't say it. The problem with what I just read is that it's based on the Latin translation, and Irenaeus wrote in Greek. Irenaeus' original Greek works survive only in fragments, and the complete manuscript of Against Heresies survives only in a Latin translation by an unidentified translator who is known to be incompetent. Where we have the Greek fragments to compare with the Latin is known to be frankly barbarous. That's actually the term the translators wrote in their introduction in Schaff's series on the Antinicene Fathers about the Latin version of Irenaeus' works. The Latin version is an absolutely terrible translation, and what I just read to you is from the Latin translation, which says, Terra panis, percipiens invocationem Dei, which means earthly bread when it receives the invocation of God. For 1,500 years, that understanding prevailed. It originates from about the 3rd century, and it's just an awful, awful translation saying that the bread takes on two realities at the consecration. It makes it look like Irenaeus is offering consecrated bread to the Father. And on this point, the Roman Catholic apologist is going to accept the Latin because it just makes more sense to him. He really believes Irenaeus was referring to the offering of consecrated bread and wine as the consistent announcement of the union of flesh and spirit. But as I mentioned, he's talking about the tithe. His reference to the union of flesh and spirit has to do with the offering of created food. And Irenaeus, in fact, is talking about the tithe. Fortunately for us, and unfortunately for the Roman apologists, this is one of the sections of Against Heresies for which the original Greek has since surfaced. And it turns out this is one of the sections of which the barbarous Latin translation earns its bad reputation. It turns out in the Greek, which is to say in Irenaeus' native tongue, what he wrote was not earthly bread when it receives the invocation of God is no longer common bread, but the Eucharist consisting of two realities, but rather earthly bread when it receives the summons of God is no longer common bread, but the Eucharist consisting of two realities. The Greek phrase he uses is ekklesin to Theo, which simply means the summons of God. Remember when I said Irenaeus was talking about the tithe offering and the early church considered the tithe offerings to be the fulfillment of Malachi's prophecy of an acceptable sacrifice of the Gentiles, and they referred to the tithe offering as the Eucharist?
That's right.
Well, remember that it was also Malachi who said that God summons the tithe into the storehouse. He says, bring ye all the tithes into the storehouse. It's Malachi 3:10. In other words, he summons the tithe, and when he summons it, it becomes the Eucharist, which, as we know, is the tithe. It turns out Irenaeus had not written that earthly bread, when it receives the consecration, becomes the Eucharist. He said that earthly bread, when it receives the summons, is no longer common bread, but the Eucharist, consisting of two realities, earthly and heavenly, in reference to the tithe offering. He was not referring to transubstantiation. He makes it plainly obvious in the following paragraph, in which he says that when we set aside earthly bread to care for the poor, we are offering that tithe on a heavenly altar for God to use for his purposes. It is earthly in that it is the product of our toil. It is heavenly in that it was set aside for God's use. I can't stress enough the significance of that Latin mistranslation. If you take the Latin translation as authoritative, you have proof of the Roman Catholic mass sacrifice because Irenaeus appears to be offering consecrated bread. Take the Greek, which is what he actually wrote in, take that as authoritative, and you have a simple tithe offering of bread that has been set aside to feed the poor, just like we were saying. When it was just bread, it was common and earthly. When it was set aside for the Lord's purpose, that is, when it was summoned as a tithe, it became heavenly with heavenly use. Irenaeus' exact words were that it becomes the Eucharist, the tithe offering, in accordance with God summoning the tithe in Malachi 3:10 and his prophecy in Malachi 1:11 that the Gentiles would offer an acceptable sacrifice. And the early church understood that to be the Eucharist, the tithe offering. So you might imagine that when the Greek original finally was received into circulation in the 18th century, that scholars around the world would have rejoiced to have at last corrected a 1,500-year-old barbarous Latin translation, right? Honest scholarship would have rejoiced to discover the Latin error and finally have the Greek to correct it. Yeah, that's exactly what you'd think. Instead, what followed is probably one of the most shameful and embarrassing cover-ups in all of Eucharistic historiography. And if I didn't have the evidence for this, I would consider this a conspiracy theory, but it is the most shameful and embarrassing episode in all of Eucharistic studies. Instead of applying the Greek to correct the barbarous Latin, the scholars opted instead to use the barbaric Latin to correct Irenaeus. and simply redacted his Greek word ekklesion, which means summons, and clearly refers to the tithe offering, and they changed it to epiklesion in reference to the invocation, forcing Irenaeus to refer to the consecration in order to make it match the Latin. What we saw when that Greek first entered circulation in 1743 was that they said, okay, wow, he says, we were expecting epiklesion, but he said ekklesion. So they just added a footnote saying that epiklesion is the preferred reading, and by and large, that's the wording that the scholars have adopted. So I mentioned that in the article, actually, is Roman Catholic Jacques Minier in his 1857 actually, it's not a translation, it's the original Greek with the Latin next to it, and he has a footnote next to ekklesion, and at the bottom of the page it says, well, epiklesion is preferred. In other words, we prefer that he be referring to the consecration instead of to the summoning of the tithe, and so everybody should interpret it as invocation or consecration. So the difference, of course, is monumental. You use the barbarous Latin to correct the Greek, and you have Irenaeus saying that we offered God his own son, because when the bread is consecrated, it becomes the Eucharist, consisting of two realities, earthly and heavenly. And it appears to refer to an offering of consecrated bread and wine, consistently announcing the union of flesh and spirit in the transubstantiated bread. But use the Greek to correct the barbarous Latin, and you have Irenaeus saying that we offered God his own created food, because when the bread is summoned by God as a tithe, it really is his bread, because he is both Jesus' Father and the Creator, and when it receives the summons, it becomes the Eucharist, because it's now been set aside to feed the poor, and offered on a heavenly altar, and therefore consists of two realities, earthly bread set aside for heavenly purposes. Not only is that more consistent with Irenaeus' immediate context in chapter 18, because it compares the heretic's offering of created food to the Father with the Christian's offering of created food to the Father, and concludes that our offering of created food is more consistent than theirs, but it also is more consistent with him more broadly speaking, because Irenaeus has made clear throughout his work that created food consistently announces the union of flesh and spirit. What is more, the Greek is consistent with the broader comparison between the Christian worldview, in which our God does in fact interact with creation, and the Gnostic worldview that insists that a good God does not and cannot interact with creation. If a kind, loving God does not interact with fallen creation, the gospel is emptied of its power, and God cannot save us. That is why Irenaeus makes the threefold point in Against Heresies that the Trinitarian God does indeed interact with creation, and in fact interacts with the elements of the Lord's Supper. According to Irenaeus, God the Spirit causes the vine and the stalk to produce the kernel of wheat and the grape, which will be made into bread and wine, according to Against Heresies 5:2-3. God the Father summons it as a tithe, in Against Heresies 4:18-5, and God the Son speaks the word of God over it to make it the body and blood of Christ for us. Irenaeus has all three persons of the Trinity interacting with created food, disproving the Gnostics, who said that heavenly spiritual beings cannot and do not interact with creation. The key point here is that scholars have the same evidence in their hands that I do, and knew full well that the Latin translation is terrible. In fact, they're the ones that were putting the footnotes saying that we prefer a different reading. They should have rejoiced finally to have the Greek to correct the Latin, and instead opted to use the Latin to correct the Greek and simply change Irenaeus' original Greek to make it more consistent with the Latin and their 1,500-year-old liturgy that was frankly 300 years too young to be apostolic. And frankly, that's dishonest, and Protestant scholars are just as culpable. And the result is a reconstruction of Irenaeus' second-century liturgy to make it more consistent with the medieval Roman Catholic liturgy that was utterly foreign to Irenaeus and utterly foreign to the early church. So that's a lot to say, but I wouldn't say it if I didn't have the evidence, and the evidence is right there. As soon as that Greek came available, instead of correcting the Latin, they used the Latin to correct the Greek that they just discovered and make Irenaeus say something more consistently with what they'd been doing for 1,500 years, instead of recognizing that Irenaeus had been mistranslated and subsequently abused by the scholars.
That's a tremendous cover-up that is going on there, and you're the first one I've ever heard discuss this and bring this point up. That's really really fascinating stuff, Tim, and thank you for your scholarship. I really appreciate that. Now, what I wanted to do, we talked some about the Roman Catholic apologists. I wanted to talk a little bit about the Protestant side of this. Along with the dishonesty of the Roman Catholic scholars, you noted in your review that Protestants have not used discernment when reading these Roman Catholic scholars. For example, you wrote that Rome's extraordinary deception of making Irenaeus an advocate of the mass sacrifice is, quote, is made even more remarkable by Protestants who have been complicit in advancing it, end quote. Now, why do you think the Protestants have allowed themselves to be so easily swayed by dishonest Roman Catholic arguments concerning Irenaeus and his supposed support for the mass sacrifice?
Well, as I mentioned, the Protestant scholars are just as culpable. And what you'll notice is that by and large, the prevailing Protestant analysis of Irenaeus is heavily Anglican. It was crafted in the 18th and 19th centuries. That was an era of the Anglo-Catholic or Oxford movement in which Anglicans were tussling with Rome over whose ecclesiology was more ancient and more apostolic. And it was the era when a prominent Anglican, John Henry Newman, left the Anglican communion to become Roman Catholic and ultimately became one of the Pope's cardinals. William Wigan Harvey from 1857 has a translation of Irenaeus, and he was an Anglican priest, and he supported the substitution of the Greek word because he felt it was more consistent with the Latin. Edward Bouverie Pusey, the Anglican minister, he reintroduced the doctrine of the real presence into the Anglican communion based on Irenaeus. George Trevor, 1876, also Anglican. Philip Schaff, 1885, Anglican. All were very favorable to the Roman interpretation and largely would agree that in some way we offer to God the symbols of his Son in the Lord's Supper after the consecration of the elements. They had an incentive to interpret Irenaeus as if he had offered consecrated bread and wine in the supper, because they all believed he did. In their 19th century liturgy, they reflect that. There was enormous pressure to establish apostolicity for the Anglican liturgy, and there was no incentive apart from academic honesty to allow the Greek to correct the Latin here. You can imagine the pressure they were under when someone like John Cardinal Newman, who is easily the most celebrated departure from Anglicanism in the 19th century, when he is making the arguments that, hey, listen, your Anglican liturgy isn't Roman Catholic enough, and I'm leaving to go back to the Pope. What kind of pressure they're under for academic apostolicity to show that we're consistent with the fathers and we're consistent with the early church. And when you're in a situation where you have to justify your current liturgy to make it fit, you're tempted to just leave Irenaeus the way he was in the Latin, because your liturgy is consistent with that. And I'll just have to say that I do have to give a hat tip to John Cable from 1872, also a leader of the Oxford movement, but his translation of Irenaeus is actually correct. He used the Greek, and he actually renders it the summons of God instead of the invocation of God. So I can't say that all these men ignored the obvious. John Cable did not, but he's nonetheless led the Oxford movement and was responsible for the Anglican liturgy in which the consecrated elements of bread and wine are offered to the Father, even if they're only done so symbolically or in some substantive way in which they represent or are in a mysterious way the body and blood of Christ. The biblical liturgy does not do that. The biblical liturgy does not offer the body and blood of Christ to God, even symbolically. The biblical liturgy was to offer our tithes to the Father in accordance with the apostolic instructions to do so, and then to take some of the bread and wine, consecrate, and eat it. So before the consecration, you have an offering your bread and wine and other things that are offered but not eaten, and then you consecrate some bread and wine and you eat it, but you don't offer it. That's the biblical liturgy right there. But the Anglican liturgy had so bought into the Latin version of Irenaeus and the perception that the early church offered consecrated bread and wine to the Lord's Supper, in the Lord's Supper, they were under no incentive apart from just strictly academic honesty to change their liturgy to make it conform to the scriptures, because they were in a battle with Rome over who's more faithful to the fathers. In that kind of pressure, in that kind of environment, where you actually have high-ranking Anglicans leaving for Rome and you're tussling with each other about who's more apostolic, there wasn't a lot of incentive there to say, you know what, maybe we've all been wrong, because you'd get thrown out of the debate, right?
Right.
So
right.
What's interesting is even today, is we're facing something similar. Is the federal vision rears its head every once in a while, and It was put down in 2007 at the General Assembly of the PCA, but it keeps on coming back in one way or another. And what's really interesting is I went back and looked at it, and I said, you know, it's interesting. These proponents of the federal vision are also advancing that same view that, you know, in order for us to all come together, let's all just acknowledge that the Eucharistic sacrifice in some mysterious way presents Christ's death to the Father. That's Jim Jordan in his article, Doing the Lord's Supper, from November 1995. And Jeffrey Myers in his book, The Lord's Service, in 2003 said, what I'm arguing for is that the Eucharistic prayer is made to God and the death of Jesus is showed forth to him as the people listen and participate. And Peter Lighthart in his Eucharistic Sacrifice, an article of January 2017, he said, in the Lord's Supper, the tokens of Christ's death are presented to the Father. He remembers his promise, and Christ gives himself with all gifts. Now, all these men are trying to outdo each other and trying to be more consistent with the fathers, more consistent with the apostles, more consistent with the ancient church, thinking that the ancient church presented consecrated bread and wine to the Father. And it's all a lie. They didn't. And Irenaeus didn't. But Irenaeus is the fulcrum on which all this turns, because they go to Irenaeus and they say, hey, if he believed that there were two realities present in the bread and wine and we offer it after the consecration, then he must know something that we don't know from the scriptures. He must know that we're supposed to be offering consecrated bread and wine to the Father, and that is apostolic. Fact is, that practice did not come up until the end of the 4th century. And for the first 300 years of Christianity, the Eucharist was the tithe offering. And then some of that bread was taken to use for the supper. And so the supper was sometimes called Eucharist too, but the sacrifice was just the tithe offering.
Well, Tim, that's really interesting how you connect the misuse of Irenaeus and bring that over, and that even has implications for the federal vision issue.
Yeah, what I found is throughout the federal vision argument, there was what I consider to be something very similar to the Anglo-Catholic or Oxford movement of the 19th century occurring in the 21st century, as the same arguments were being made. You know, in order to be faithful to our tradition, in order to recognize that the church preceded Martin Luther and that there were all these different practices between the 1500s and the time of the apostles, that we really need to embrace everything that happened between the apostles and the Reformation, including Thomas Aquinas and Francis of Assisi and all mm-hmm. that. And I listened to that and I said, you know, Francis of Assisi reintroduced Eucharistic adoration in the 12th century to Italy. And he was an idolater. You know, Thomas Aquinas was an illogical man with all sorts of crazy arguments. I know the Roman Catholics love him and some Protestants love him, but he's just not that intelligent. Actually, it's probably not fair to say he's not that intelligent. He's not that accurate. He's not that good. And you go back and even read his arguments about why we need to mix water and wine in the liturgy. He's using forged documents and fraudulent arguments in order to prove that the apostles actually taught this. And it's nonsense. And I don't think that we need to go back to the high medieval era and decide that's the point at which we have unity with all of our Christian brethren and establish that. But what I found with, you know, Jeffrey Myers and Peter Lighthart and Jim Jordan, they were all militating for going back earlier than the Reformation to find our unity. Well, I say, let's go back to the scriptures to find our unity. And when we do that, we find that for the first 300 years, nobody knew anything about venerating relics, venerating the true cross, perpetual virginity of Mary, sacrifice of the consecrated elements of the Lord's Supper, use of votive candles in worship, and the Assumption of Mary, priestly celibacy. I mean, you want to go back and find unity. Go back to the scriptures like Irenaeus did, and then when you do that, you'll find for 300 years, the liturgy was very, very consistently biblical. The ecclesiology was consistently biblical. They did tend to migrate toward a loosely episcopal structure, but not always. And so I know that there were bishops in different metropolitan cities and all that, but there were some places that didn't have a single bishop, but they actually had a session of presbyters. But besides that, they were functionally Protestant. And what's interesting is whether it's the Anglo-Catholic movement or the 19th century, the Federal Vision movement now, there's always a temptation to somehow go back to what Roman Catholicism is doing, because for some reason, the high medieval liturgy is considered really the touchstone of of truth for some people. And that's why, you know, Jeffrey Myers is trying to convince Protestants that we need to get back in touch with the early church and present the symbols of Christ's suffering to the Father to remind him of his covenant. Jesus didn't institute the Lord's Supper to remind his Father of anything. His Father knew exactly what was going on and why he did it. He instituted the Lord's Supper to remind us. And it's amazing to me that someone would take this misunderstanding of church history, take this Roman Catholic medieval version of the Lord's Supper, and the fraudulent rewriting of history that's taken place with Irenaeus, and then try to tell us that in order for us to be truly apostolic and scriptural, we need to turn the Lord's Supper into an offering of Christ's body and blood to the Father to remind the Father of what he did. Now, that's crazy. I just think that's absolutely ridiculous, but that's where we are, and that's a big reason why I believe that we need to get back in touch with Irenaeus and go back to what Irenaeus actually said. Not because he's authoritative, because of how wily and subtle the Roman apologist is in using him to steal sheep and deceive them.
I think that's a great point. Thank you for making that, Tim. Now, what I wanted to do is talk a little bit about the closing section of your Trinity Review. And in the closing section, it has the header, "The Quintessentially Protestant Irenaeus." Now, why do you say that?
I have this listed first, but I really don't have them all listed in any particular order. But he rebuked the Bishop of Rome for overstepping his authority. I mean, that's the quintessential Protestant right there. He joined with the other bishops of the world and rebuked Victor, the Bishop of Rome, because he was trying to excommunicate people for just a simple practice, a custom that had developed in a certain congregation that wasn't unscriptural and it wasn't immoral. And Victor, the Bishop of Rome, tried to excommunicate the bishops of Asia. And Irenaeus stepped in with other bishops and rebuked the Bishop of Rome. So he obviously did not agree with the Roman Church all the time, and therefore that's why I'm confident that the Latin translation that says Irenaeus says all churches must agree with Rome is obviously incorrect. He believed that the tradition of the apostles was contained in the scriptures. And beyond what was in the scriptures, congregations were free to establish their own local customs and practices. They couldn't contradict the scriptures, but they also couldn't impose their customs on others. His liturgy was Protestant, in which an offertory or the tithe oblation precedes the consecration of the bread and wine for the supper. And in the supper, the consecrated bread and wine are not offered to the Father. He called the bread and wine the body and blood of Christ, but so do we. We understand it in its symbolic nature. And Irenaeus makes this point when he compares the Eucharist as a tithe offering and the Eucharist as a supper. He said that the Eucharist as a tithe is offered in pure mind and in faith without hypocrisy, in well-grounded hope and fervent love, offering the first fruits of his own created things. So here's Irenaeus saying, in the Eucharist, we are offering created things to the Father as a tithe, and we do that in a pure mind, in faith, without hypocrisy, in hope, and in love. But then he says, in the same way that the bread ceases to be common bread when it is set aside as a tithe, our bodies become suited for heaven when we eat the bread that has been consecrated. And then I'll just read what he says. He says, "For as the bread, which is produced of earth, when it receives the invocation of God," actually the summons of God is the correct wording, "when it receives the summons of God, is no longer common bread, but the Eucharist, consisting of two realities, so also our bodies, when they receive the Eucharist, are no longer corruptible, having the hope of resurrection to eternity." When you read Irenaeus through the lens of the second century church and his arguments against the Gnostics and understanding what the Eucharist was, what the consecration was, it becomes clear in his statement that the bread becomes of benefit to the recipient in the same way the bread became suitable for the Lord's purposes. That is, when it's received by faith, in a pure conscience, in hope and love, and trusting in what God has done for us, the bread does not become beneficial to us because it has been transubstantiated. It becomes beneficial to us by the disposition of the receiver, not by transubstantiation by a priest. And in Irenaeus, we don't find a devotion of Mary, papal or Roman primacy, transubstantiation, the mass sacrifice, the Roman Catholic mass sacrifice, veneration of relics, veneration of images, icons, incense, veneration of the cross, prayers for the dead. What we find is a sound biblical liturgy, a refutation of heretics, and confidence in the sufficiency of scriptures. Well, that's Protestant. So that when I say he's quintessentially Protestant, I say what's utterly lacking in Irenaeus is any of the medieval trappings of the Roman ecclesiology and the Roman liturgy. What's missing is the great Roman error that came up at the end of the 4th century.
Well, that the things that you just went over there, I mean, that's extremely damaging to the cause of anyone who would want to use Irenaeus as proof that the distinctives of the Roman Catholic Church appeared early on, because it's just not there.
That's right. That's right. He's I think that he's a fantastic read, and I think that I encourage people to read him, but I would just say be careful, because you do have to read him not only in the context of the second century and in the context of Gnostics that he was refuting, but also in the context that much of what we have exists from a Latin translation that's known to be terrible, and also in the context that even when we have the Greek to correct the bad Latin, the scholars have on occasion opted not to use it to do so, because Irenaeus can be used by the scholars to advance an agenda and a liturgy that they prefer. And so someone might say, for example, that, well, Tim, aren't you doing the same thing? I said, well, hey, maybe I am. Go find out. But I'm not the one changing his original Greek to make it say something that I want. When I tell you that they changed the Greek, I'm saying we ought to stick with his original Greek. Yeah. I'm the one saying we should stick with what he said instead of what we wished he'd said. So, but I think that, you know, to conclude there, I would just say that there's nothing so precious to the Roman Catholic religion as apostolic continuity, and yet it's the one thing they lack. The Roman religion is a novelty of the late 4th century. The early church was functionally Protestant. And I hear so many testimonies from Protestants who convert to Rome, and it's almost always because they went back and they read the church fathers, and they went back all the way to the late 4th century and figured, you know what? Late 4th century is good enough for me. Whatever's going on then must be what was going on for the 3 centuries before that. And I say, you go back a little bit further than that, and you'll find that all those things that Roman Catholicism claims as apostolic were all novelties, and the early church denied them, or it hadn't even entered their mind to speak them, much less refute them. So,
well, Tim, thank you for sharing your expertise on Irenaeus. That was a fascinating lesson that you just laid out there for all of us. One thing before we wrap it up here, I do know that you do writing. You have a blog, for example. Could you tell the listeners where they can find your work online?
Yes, there's a couple things. I do have a blog. It's called White Horse Blog. If you just search Out of His Mouth, which is a reference to Revelation, when the sword of God's word comes out of Christ's mouth to correct and smite the nations. It's a reference to the scriptures. So I am actually working on a series now about, you know how I mentioned all these errors that came up at the end of the 4th century, the veneration of the cross, veneration of relics, sacrifice of the supper, of the consecrated elements, the veneration of Mary, perpetual virginity of Mary, and Assumption. What's interesting is after the 4th century, there's a whole string of heresies that come up that Roman Catholicism is fighting against, and they're always labeled Gnostics or Manichaeans or whatever, but they all have one thing in common. They don't venerate relics. They don't believe in the real presence of Christ in the supper. They don't venerate the cross. They don't believe that Mary was sinless. They don't believe that Mary was perpetually a virgin. They don't believe that the Pope of Rome is authoritative. They don't believe in Roman primacy or papal primacy. What's very interesting is that we don't have the testimony of those actual alleged heretics. We only have the accusations against them. But what is consistent about all the accusations is that all those heresies, all those heretics, appear to reject the novelties of Roman Catholicism that came up at the end of the 4th century. So I'm doing a series on that, about all these heresies that were out there that were in fact Protestants. And I'm also at Thorn Crown Ministries. I have a couple blogs. One is eschatological, and it's called the Danielic Imperative, and it just deals with Daniel's prophecies and how to understand the New Testament references to those prophecies. But the one that's probably going to be most interesting to the listeners today is called The Diving Board, in which I analyze conversion testimonies of Protestants who've converted to Roman Catholicism and show that they thought they were really, really deep in history, but in fact they were extremely shallow in history, and they never would have converted to Roman Catholicism if they'd truly been deep in history. That's why it's called the diving board, because we get very deep in history.
All right. So, well, yeah, no, go ahead.
Yeah, so go to thorncrownministries.com and look up the diving board. You'll get a kick out of it.
All right, all right. Well, Tim, once again, thanks so much for bringing your expertise today on Irenaeus and taking time out of your busy schedule to sit down and to talk with me. I'm sure listeners will really enjoy listening to what you have to say. And again, just thanks so much.
Hey, you're welcome. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be back, and I'm glad you've been successful at this.
All right. Well, in closing then, for my guest Tim Kaufman and for Trinity Foundation President Tom Judaitis, this is Steve Matthews. Thanks for listening. I invite you to join me again for the next episode of Trinity Foundation Radio. The Bible alone is the Word of God.
This is Tom Judaitis thanking you for listening to Trinity Foundation Radio. Please join host Steve Matthews next time for another episode of Trinity Foundation Radio. For more information about the Trinity Foundation, please visit our website at www.trinityfoundation.org. We have over 300 articles you can read, download, and/or print, and over 200 MP3 lectures that you can listen to, download, or you can also request CDs in the MP3 format. We also have over 65 books in print, and other media which you can purchase from our website. Again, our website is www.trinityfoundation.org. And remember, the Bible alone is the Word of God. Thank you.